everybody. Welcome to tonight's program. My name is Mike Malloy. Thanks for tuning in. No, we're not going to stream video tonight because I feel like warmed over death and still dealing with this this pollen stuff. We had some rain here in the North Georgia Mountains, the foothills of North Georgia Mountains today, so that should help. So we'll be back to video streaming tomorrow night. But I just look and feel like something that crawled out from under a wharf in Boston Harbor. Laura Flanders will be here tomorrow night. Also, Thursday and Friday. Thursday and Friday, we have a two-parter from Bob Alexander about smoking. I know it's weird. It's weird. This is not what he writes about. But if you are a cigarette smoker, I want you to hear this. This is not a kick-your-ass kind of thing. This is a... you're going to find this very interesting. So if you smoke, don't forget tomorrow night. All right? Right? Rachel Maddow has Paul Krugman on. I have smoking tips. don't laugh. It makes you cough. The difference between major market success and our little radio program here. Remember in the Seinfeld, the Seinfeld series, that the one about no soup for you, the soup Nazi? Believe this or not, I found this a little bit hard to believe, but according to the Associated Press in Dallas, no divorce for you if you're gay. No divorce. A woman named Angelique Naylor got married in Massachusetts to the woman that she got married to. They adopted a baby. And then started, like a lot of married couples do, started having arguments and fights that couldn't be resolved. So Angelique Naylor filed for divorce. And that left her fighting both the woman she married in Massachusetts and the state of Texas. State of Texas says that a union granted in a state where same-sex marriage is legal can't be dissolved with a divorce in a state where it's not legal. Right? You can't get married if gay folk cannot get married to other gay folk in Texas. So if you show up and you're already married, because Massachusetts or one of the other states that recognizes gay marriage, and you move to Texas and you're married and you try to get a divorce, state of Texas tells you no. No divorce for you. Oh, my God. A judge in Austin, Texas, went ahead and granted a divorce anyway, but Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott is appealing the divorce decision. He's appealing it. He's saying, no, 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 no. He also is appealing a divorce granted to a gay couple in Dallas, saying, and this is what the Texas Attorney General says. He says, protecting the traditional definition of marriage means doing the same thing for the traditional definition of divorce. Oh, my God. OMFG. OMFG squared. Ah! Anyway, tomorrow, Texas State Appeals Court is scheduled to hear arguments on the Dallas case. In the case of the Dallas couples, two men, they declined to be interviewed by the AP, but they're known only as JB and HB in court filings. They had an amicable separation with no disputes on separation of property, no children involved. The couple who married in 4 years ago in Massachusetts has separated 2 years later, simply want an official divorce. Anyway, the attorney says his client didn't ask for a divorce. We simply asked for the courtesy of divorce. That's all. And FYI, Massachusetts in 2004 became the first state to let same-sex couples tie the knot. Now Connecticut, Iowa, New Hampshire, Vermont, and D.C. also allow them. Gay and lesbian couples who turn to the courts when they break up are getting mixed results across the nation. A Pennsylvania judge last month refused to divorce two women who married in Massachusetts. New York grants such divorces, even though New York doesn't allow same-sex marriages. Oh, my God. Isn't this insane? Isn't this madness? Isn't this just crazy, drooling, booger-eating insanity? Somebody please tell these insane state apparatchiks that marriage is a oh, never mind. Never mind. Ed Rendell, is he the governor? Yeah, he's the governor of, PA? He's still the governor, isn't he? Yeah. He says the media have been overhyping the Tea Parties. Interestingly, didn't we say something to this effect on this program late last week or maybe yesterday that these Tea Party freaks are getting off? I guess it was yesterday. Getting an awful lot of media coverage. Awful lot of media coverage. And that's because media are waiting, television is waiting for these people to go rabid and start attacking each other. You know, some of these people show up with guns and their automatic weapons and their stupid misspelled signs. And eventually, a couple of them are going to get drunk and one's going to scream, Sean Hannity is God, and the other one's going to say, Glenn Beck is God, and there's going to be a shootout. Can't wait for that. Oh, man. Wouldn't it be great? Pow, pow, pow. Thud, thud. Anyway, Ed Rendell says the media have been overhyping the tea baggers. The rallies, given this a very small number of people who have actually been attending. Rendell said on was Press the Meat on Sunday to David Gregory, he says, I think, David, the first thing we have to define is what the Tea Party is. What's the Tea Party itself? If you say it's the anger that people feel about the economy, etc., that's giving the Tea Party too much credit. Rendell says, we had two recent Tea Party demonstrations in Washington. One, a week before the health care vote, drew about 1,000 people. The tax day rally, by the organizer's own estimate, was 1,500 people. If I organized a rally for stronger laws to protect puppies, I would get 100,000 people to Washington. So I think the media has blown the Tea Partiers themselves out of proportion. Ah, good God. It really is. It is, you know, these little tiny crowds showing up, and they're usually the same people. Have you noticed that? Same people wearing the same double-knit clothing. Have you noticed that? Same pastel-colored double-knit clothing left over from the mid-70s. There they are, carrying their misspelled signs. A couple of them have a you know, you think it's a gun strapped to their waist. Actually, it's one of those hole punchers. What do you call those things? Hole puncher? or it'll be a super big cell phone, right? But they wear it. They show up at the Tea Party and they come strutting on with their Obama is a Nazi moron sign. And they have this hole puncher strapped to their belt. And they, you know, they want anybody to look real close. They'll see it's a hole puncher. Why are you carrying a hole puncher? Ain't no hole puncher. That's my gun. That's a hole puncher. No, it ain't. Look the other way. That's my gun. You sorry little pissants. Oh, my goodness. Charlie Crist is catching old Billy Hell, as we say in the South, down in Florida. Poor Charlie Crist. Decent guy, really is. You know, I've said before many times, so many times, I know you're sick of hearing it, that, you know, all Republicans are liars, all Republicans are scum, especially the Republican office holders. And I, you know, I didn't leave myself any wiggle room. I guess I should have a little wiggle room by saying all elected officials of all political parties are scum and liars. That would give me a little wiggle room. Or by saying most or 98% of all elected members of all political parties are scum, liars, cheats, sneaks, and cowards. But I didn't. I didn't give myself any wiggle room, so I don't know how to get out of this, except to say that a lot of things Charlie Crist has done as the Republican governor of Florida, I find myself, you know, nodding my head up and down going, yep, 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 that's right, Charlie, yep, yep, yep. Maybe it's because Jeb Bush was such a thug, such a sneaky, lying thug, makes Charlie Crist look good. Or Charlie Crist just looks good on his own. I'm not sure which. But I'll tell you what he did. Kay Petrini, our education correspondent, sent me a quick note about this. You're going to find this interesting. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Love and marriage, love and marriage. They go together like a horse and carriage. This I'll tell you. Institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry, and they will say it's elementary. Try, try, try to separate them. It's an illusion. Try.
It is 21 past the hour. Anyway, Charlie Crist. Kay wrote the same thing, our education correspondent. Right, Mike, I'm in a state of utter disbelief because I actually have something encouraging to report from, of all things, a Republican. I like the way she says something encouraging to report from, of all things, a Republican. Granted, Kay writes, it seems to be a political move on his part, but if Charlie Crist gets that linking so-called merit pay to standardized testing results does nothing for students and everything for the testing companies, you know, money. What's wrong with President Obama and his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan? Yeah, those two seem to really be out of it. And what she's writing about was Florida Governor Charlie Crist a couple days ago vetoed the most far-reaching education bill of its kind in the country. Legislation that would have made it easier to fire teachers and link their pay to student test scores. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that I think that is an asinine idea. In the first place, testing like this madness about testing, that is to isolate students of color. The problem with it is you get a lot of white students caught up in that net also. But that's what the No Child Left Behind thing is. It means the exact opposite. Don't forget, backwards world is where we lived for 8 years with George W. Bush. The idea of No Child Left Behind is keep testing them and testing them and testing them. And more kids will drop out. More and more kids will, schools will close. And you have your uneducated workforce. So that 5, 6, 8, 10 years from now, there'll be this massive, uneducated, poverty-stricken workforce for capitalist America to exploit the hell out of. That's what No Child Left Behind is about. You didn't know that? Has nothing to do with education and everything to do with producing millions of functionally illiterate worker bees, who will go into the factories once the factories come back, or the mines, or the uranium pits, or wherever corporate America decides to set them up. And the factories will come back when they can get rid of the pesky unions, what's left of them, and that irritating pain in the ass minimum wage. What is up with that? So that's what No Child Left Behind is about. Florida Governor Charlie Crist vetoed legislation put together by the Republicans in his legislature that would have made it easier to fire teachers and link their pay to student test scores. And as the Associated Press reports, the veto put him at odds with Republican leaders and former Governor Jeb, I will do anything for money, Bush, who worked hard for the bill's passage and touted it in national media interviews. Crist denied the veto was a signal he's about to drop out of the Republican U.S. Senate primary, where he badly trails in the polls. Yeah, he's running against this neo-Nazi named Rubio. I think he was, his parents must be Cuban exiles, and Rubio is one of the, is he Italian? Is he Cuban? What is he? I don't even know. Maybe he's Polish. I have no idea. But Crist ought to do what Holy Joe Lieberman did. I don't know how that's, I don't know. I'm going to get beat in the primary. I don't know what to do. Maybe I should run as an independent. What do you think? And then he did that. I don't know. I don't know what to do. Let me have a cup of coffee. These damn Connecticut voters. I was going to be the vice president.
So Charlie Crist may do that. He decided to become an independent.
He said the veto was not about politics, but about the state school children. The school, really, Charlie? Okay. Charlie Crist once favored the legislation, said he still supports the concept of pay for performance and holding teachers accountable. You know, this is the part I don't get. Every school should have an active PTA, Parent Teacher Association, active school board, that is not politicized. That's how I keep track of the teachers. I mean, what? This is the corporatization of everything. If you're a school teacher and you can't show a profit, i.e., if for some reason the little boogers that come into your classroom
are not being encouraged to study at home. They watch too much television because their parents are either irresponsible or not there, or fighting because they lost their jobs and about to lose their house. Anyway, the kids, the little kids, are lost. Lost in a lost world. They don't know what the hell to do. So these kids come to school, most of them ill-fed, certainly not educated at home, which is where real education occurs. School is just to organize the education that the kids are supposed to get in the world and at home, right? They come in thinking that there's sky spooks running everything and angels flitting around and, you know, people rising from the dead. And then the school teachers are told to teach these kids. Eh? And if they don't, if you don't turn a profit, the profit being a certain test score, if you don't turn a profit, well, we're going to fire you just like we did to the workers in this country. Well, Charlie Crist said no. A little bit more about this when we come back. Stay with us.
What you gonna do when the silence calls your name? What you gonna do when the silence calls your name? Make your speeches to the wind, count the votes, then laugh in. What you gonna do when the silence falls?
He's the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, so Governor Charlie Crist in Florida vetoed a bill passed by his state's legislature that would made it easier to fire teachers and link their pay to student test scores, which to me is madness. It's just absolute insanity. But this is the profit and loss theory of education. This is... to create even more so. When I was a kid, they used to track us. Corporate America back in the 40s and 50s in preparation for the, well, that was before I went to elementary school, but by the time I got there, the plans had already been laid. They needed a certain number, millions of, half educated or undereducated workers. These are people who would go into the factories and, spend their lives working on an assembly line for as little amount of money as corporate America could pay them. Of course, they were strong unions at the time, so that little amount of money actually built a strong middle class in this country after World War II. Had nothing to do with corporate America wanting to build consumers. It had everything to do with unions wanting to make sure that their members could live. And then also in the elementary schools, the vast majority of the kids were tracked into this undereducated model. And then there were some of us, and I happened to be in the group that was tracked the other way. We were tracked into academic classes, academic curriculum. And the idea was that we would go to university and become the managerial class, again for corporate America, but we would become the managerial class. Well, a lot of us fooled them by taking the free public education, K through 12, and then just giving them all the middle finger and saying, no, I'm not going to participate. I may go to university, but I'm not going to graduate. I'm not going to take business administration. I'll never forget when I left high school, I qualified for a Ford Foundation full scholarship. And the only reason I tell you this is just to make a point. Full scholarship to the University of Toledo. The only catch was I had to spend the first 2 years in the College of Business Administration and get, I don't think we had associate degrees back then. I don't think we had two-year degrees. But that was the catch. The idea being, okay, we'll pay for everything, but we need managers, you know. We lost 800,000 men in World War II. We're rebuilding the worker machine in this country. We're rebuilding the factory workers and the drones, and we need some people to be managers. That's exactly how it went. If you are of a certain age, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Charlie Crist said, no, I'm not going to link merit pay or retention of teachers based on how they do on the test scores, how the kids do. That's insane. That's a corporate America approach. That's a P&L approach to education. Chris said he began having second thoughts. First, he supported the idea. He said he started having second thoughts about how the bill would achieve those goals when a friend back home in St. Pete called him and questioned how his special needs child could be fairly tested. Well, now that raises an interesting question, doesn't it? If the public school teachers are mandated by law to teach special needs children, and if the special needs child or children do not rise to the no child left behind testing levels, you fire the teacher? So anyway, Charlie Crist said, no, I'm not going to do it, and he vetoed the bill. And now, of course, it's going to be used against him by this Rubio freak who is going to swear up and down on a stack of Bibles or whatever holy garbage this Rubio believes in, that Charlie Crist hates educated children, when the exact opposite will be the case. But this is how it always works. Backwards world. Got an email here from Dr. Tim, who is an educator. He says, Mike, put two statistical scales side by side. First, ranked standardized test scores on one side and socioeconomic level per capita on the other. Okay? Test scores on one side and where the kid taking the test score ranks or taking the test ranks on the socioeconomic schedule here in the worker's paradise. Guess what you find out? As Dr. Tim says, it doesn't really matter the subject matter or the level of development of students. Every single measure produces an almost perfectly statistical correlation that no one seems willing to address. Right, and that's what we were talking about the other night. How are school teachers supposed to deal with public school students as they are so often presented to the school teacher? How is that so? What's a teacher to do? Again, education certainly has its genesis at home, or it should. Ongoing education, I may have been exaggerating a bit when I said all education starts at home and in the world, and then you go to school to organize and codify and put into some sort of order what you are learning. It's more than that, of course. You go to
Mike Malloy.
It is 10 before the hour. We are sharing with you some of the comments made by Barack Obama today when he addressed a subdued, I'm not going to say they were unruly fifth graders, but a subdued group, Republicans who had gathered for their annual convocation retreat, this time in Baltimore. And a couple of months ago, they invited him to come by. I don't know if the invitation was sincere or one of those ironic little twists that the Republican Party is so, or sarcastic little twists, I should say. The Republican Party is so, with which they are so identified now. But he accepted. And again, watching this thing or listening to what transpired after Obama showed up was a demonstration in, on the one hand, an adult trying to be a president, whether we agree with his policies or not. And you know my position on Obama, and I know yours. But a man trying to be the president and dealing with 10-year-olds who are supposed to be, what is that quaint phrase from two generations, three, four generations ago? Oh, that's right. The loyal opposition. A clutch of idiots who want their constituents to believe he's not even a citizen of the country. But I digress. Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, wanted to know why Obama didn't freeze spending immediately. He says, Ryan says, the spending bills that you have signed into law, the domestic and discretionary spending, has been increased by 84%. I would simply submit that we could do more and start now. You've also said that you want to take a scalpel to the budget and go through it line by line. We want to give you that scalpel. So my question is, why not start freezing spending now? And Obama goes on to explain that he didn't increase spending. Those were automatic measures that kicked in when the recession he inherited from George W. Bush reached a certain level. Why do these jerks not understand that?
I want to just push back a little bit on the underlying premise about us increasing spending by 84%. Now, look, the fact of the matter is that most of the increases in this year's budget, this past year's budget, were not as a consequence of policies that we initiated, but instead were built in as a consequence of the automatic stabilizers that kick in because of this enormous recession. So the increase in the budget for this past year was actually predicted before I was even sworn into office and had initiated any policies. Whoever was in there, Paul, and I don't think you'll dispute that, whoever was in there would have seen those same increases because of, on the one hand, huge drops in revenue, but at the same time, people were hurting and needed help. And a lot of these things happen automatically. Now, the reason that I'm not proposing the discretionary freeze take into effect this year, we prepared a budget for 2010, it's now going forward, is, again, I am just listening to the consensus among people who know the economy best. And what they will say is that if you either increased taxes or significantly lowered spending when the economy remains somewhat fragile, that would have a destimulative effect, and potentially you'd see a lot of folks losing business, more folks potentially losing jobs. That would be a mistake when the economy has not fully taken off. That's why I've proposed to do it for the next fiscal year.
Now, how much of that do you suppose registered in the reptilian brains that dominate these Republican office holders? How much of that do you think resonated with the truth, if that's the right word? The increase in the budget for this year was actually predicted before I was even sworn into office. And whoever would have been in there, whoever would have been the president, would have seen those same increases. Because of, on the one hand, huge drops in revenue, but at the same time, people were hurting and needed help. Now, that last line, people were hurting and needed help, that doesn't register with Republicans. They don't know what that means. People were hurting. Well, why didn't they pull themselves up by their own damn bootstraps? You know, that sort of thing. And he has to add, for a third time, a lot of these things happen automatically. Don't forget, those massive tax cuts that the Bush crime family initiated when they first came into office had a sunset date of 2010. That's this year. Deliberately setting it for 2010 so that the next president, had he or she been a Republican, could have said, okay, well, we're going to advocate that those tax cuts continue. But knowing, as they knew, the Bush crime family, that those tax cuts initiated when Bush took office, that they were going to cause one hellacious, a horrible recession, then it would fall, if it were a Democratic president, as Barack Obama claims to be, it would fall on his shoulders to say, okay, we're going to let those tax cuts expire, so that the Republicans in Congress could then say, ah, tax increase! You see how this works? And Barack Obama, bless his heart, still thinks he can get bipartisan support for anything? All right, we have much more. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Individual results.
Hey, Truth Seekers, this is Mike Malloy. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Mike Malloy Show, so please don't call in. We'll return live before you can say, Bush crime family.
I can hear the music playing. I can hear the word that you're saying. I can see the love light in your eyes. What's the use in looking for a nice...
Welcome back. It is just about 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy program. We are playing some selected sound clips from the back and forth today at the Republican retreat, the Republican annual Republican House caucus. I'm sorry, the annual Republican caucus retreat. This year it was in Baltimore. At invitation, Barack Obama decided to go. And in my opinion, as I said last hour, whether you agree with or support the president's positions, very few of which I do, because I'm a liberal and he is a conservative, among other reasons, you can't escape the fact that this was an adult president doing what adult presidents are supposed to do, providing leadership and dealing with an opposition party whose collective IQ is about, at least their emotional development, let me put it that way, is on the level with your average fifth grader. And again, if you were 10 years old and you're listening to this program tonight, the first question is why. The second question is thank you. The third thing I would say is no offense. I don't mean to offend you. It's just that 10-year-olds are now referred to as tweens. Back in my day, they referred to as shut up and sit down, but all of a sudden they have an identifying label and all kinds of disposable income. So, okay. But your average 10-year-old would be a lot more easy to deal with than these mental 10-year-olds that now comprise the Republican Party's elected representatives. In instance after instance, Obama clearly, articulately, comprehensively, answered questions that bordered on the ludicrous. And again, remember who the questions are coming from. They're coming from people who challenged his parentage, challenged his nationality, challenged his basic right to not just be president of the United States, I guess, but to be a United States senator, although it never came up then, or to be a member of the legislature in Illinois, although it never came up then. He was being challenged by a party whose basic tenets are fundamentally racist. They are, they have been, and they will continue to be. If you doubt that, take a look at the photos and the videos and the YouTubes. When the N-word is used, he and his wife and children are depicted as monkeys, gorillas, chimpanzees, all the racist iconography that has accumulated in this sick country for the past 200 years. There it is. So spare me an email tonight that says, oh, they're not racist. That's where this... a lot of this is coming through, coming from. Obama made one telling statement early on when he said, When you get right down to it, the difference between the two our two parties is not, on the important issues, is not as great as it's made out to be. That's an indictment to me. But then, I'm a socialist, liberal, progressive, would like to go back to just being a plain old Democrat, but can't. So, the difference between the two parties on the major issues is not as great as it's sometimes made to seem. And again, I consider that to be an indictment. The president was using that as a means of saying, come on, can't we all get along? Shelley Moore Capito or Capito? Is it Capito? I don't know. I'll go with Capito. West Virginia wanted to know what Obama would do to create jobs in her state through cap and trade policies and reducing EPA restrictions. She says, I represent the state of West Virginia. We're resource rich. We have a lot of coal, a lot of natural gas, but our miners and the folks who are working and those who are unemployed are very concerned about some of your policies in those areas, in these areas, cap and trade, an aggressive EPA, and the looming prospect of higher taxes. In our minds, these are job-killing policies. So I'm asking you, if you would be willing to relook at some of these policies with the high unemployment and unsure economy that we have now, to assure West Virginians that you're listening. Now, Obama answers, losing some points on his claim here to be pro-environment with his policies on so-called clean coal and opening new nuclear plants, as he mentioned in his address the other night.
We need a comprehensive energy policy that sets us up for a long-term future. For example, nobody's been a bigger promoter of clean coal technology than I am. Testament to that, I ended up being in a whole bunch of advertisements that you guys saw all the time about investing in ways for us to burn coal more cleanly. I've said that I'm a promoter of nuclear energy, something that I think over the last three decades has been subject to a lot of partisan wrangling and ideological wrangling. I don't think it makes sense. I think that that has to be part of our energy mix. I've said that I am supportive, and I said this two nights ago at the State of the Union, that I'm in favor of increased production. So if you look at the ideas that this caucus has, again, with respect to energy, I'm for a lot of what you said you are for.
Yeah, that's right. Sounds like damn near 100% of what they're for, Mr. President. So sharpen the drills and head to the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, huh? See, this is the part that's infuriating to me. And most of the anger, I've said before, I've fessed up. The anger is directed at myself. I made the assumption that Barack Obama was a liberal or a progressive, pro-environmentalist, somebody who would work on really clean energy technologies. As far as nuclear energy, we have a massive nuclear generator, 93 million miles from here, that if we harnessed its energy, the energy it puts out for, I'm just going to pick numbers out of thin air here, if we harnessed the energy the sun puts out in one day, we'd probably have enough energy to run every single energy requirement on this planet for the next 100 years, or 5 years, or 1 year, or 10 minutes. Pick a number. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's being ignored. Nuclear energy is not the way to go. It's clean only insofar as it doesn't send up smoke. It is the most toxic substance on Earth once that process is finished, plutonium. And where do we put it? Never mind. I'm getting off track here. He answers the question straightforwardly, and this is the part that is infuriating to me. While I don't agree with his policies, what he advocates, is the same thing Republicans have been advocating for three decades. But because he got elected as a Democrat, because his skin is dark, because he is obviously given
the one-drop rule instituted by white people in this country because he is obviously an African-American. What is he doing in the White House? You see. Jason Chaffetz, Utah, a freshman, took Obama to task for breaking his campaign promises. Mm-hmm. Breaking his campaign promises. That's something certainly unique to Washington politics, right? A president who breaks his campaign promises. Senators never do that. Representatives never do that. Democrats never do that. And certainly Republicans never do that, right? But old Jason here is going to jump all over the president's ass because he, the president, broke his campaign promises. All right. We'll get into that as soon as we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Monkey Right. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour, continuing the Q&A that occurred today. And by the way, next hour we will do a podcast trivia for Friday night. So stick around for that if you like, where you can win a one-year subscription to the downloads, podcast downloads of this program. Jason Chaffetz or Chaffetz from Utah, freshman Republican, takes Obama to task for breaking campaign promises. He says, I'm one of 22 House freshmen. We didn't create this mess. I can look you in the eye and tell you, we have not been obstructionist. The Democrats have the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And when you stood up before the American people multiple times, excuse me, and said you would broadcast the health care debates on C-SPAN, you didn't. I was disappointed. I think a lot of Americans were disappointed. You said you weren't going to allow lobbyists in the senior-most positions in your administration, yet you did. You said you go by line through the health care debate or through the health care bill, and there were six of us who sent you a letter and said we would like to take you up on your offer. We'd like to come. We never got a call. We were never involved in any of those discussions. And when you said in the House of Representatives that you were going to tackle earmarks, and in fact you didn't, you didn't want to have any earmarks in any of your bills, I jumped out of my seat and applauded you. But it didn't happen.
The truth of the matter is that if you look at the health care process just over the course of the year, overwhelmingly, the majority of it actually was on C-SPAN. Because it was taking place in congressional hearings in which you guys were participating. I mean, how many committees were there that helped to shape this bill? Countless hearings took place. Now, once it got through the committee process, and there were now a series of meetings taking place all over the Capitol trying to figure out how to get the thing together, that was a messy process. And I take responsibility for not having structured it in a way where it was all taking place in one place that could be filmed. I was confronted at the beginning of my term with an omnibus package that did have a lot of earmarks from Republicans and Democrats and a lot of people in this chamber. And the question was I going to have a big budget fight at a time when I was still trying to figure out whether or not the financial system was melting down, and we had to make a whole bunch of emergency decisions about the economy. So what I said was, let's keep them to a minimum, but I couldn't excise them all. The challenge, I guess, I would have for you as a freshman is, what are you doing inside your caucus to make sure that I'm not the only guy who's responsible for this stuff, so that we're working together?
Yeah.
I can stand here unequivocally and say that there has not been an administration who was tougher on making sure that lobbyists weren't participating in the administration than any administration that's come before us. Now, what we did was, if there were lobbyists who were on boards and commissions that were carryovers and their term hadn't completed, we didn't kick them off. We simply said that moving forward, anytime a new slot opens, they're being replaced.
Well, young Master Jason, do you get that? Do you get it? He was confronted at the beginning of his term with an omnibus spending package that did have a lot of earmarks from Republicans and Democrats and a lot of people in this chamber. Jason, did you miss that? Huh? And he goes on, the question was I going to have a big budget fight at a time I was still trying to figure out whether or not the financial system was melting down? Who brought that on, Jason? Huh? And we had to make a whole bunch of emergency decisions about the economy? Big stuff, Jason. Not little smart-assy comments and little things from an apparent jerk like you. Breaking his campaign promises, Jason? You need to go back to Utah and maybe spend another couple of years as a missionary before you go to Washington. There's something to be said for that Mormon missionary thing, where the young men go out on the road and try to convert people to Mormonism, tell them about the Book of Mormon and the angel Moroni and yada, yada, yada. Toughens him up. But apparently Jason Chaffetz here, representative freshman, freshman representative from Utah, didn't quite get the message. Maybe you need to go back on the road, Jason. Because you still haven't figured out that before you talk about the mote in the eye of the person you're looking at, check out the beam in your own.
Republicans, baby, I can't stand those Republicans. Doesn't suffer rivals. They're waving flags and guns and quoting from the Bible. I hate Republicans. I hate Republicans. Baby, I can't stand those.
Outrage. Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
Okay, 25 before the hour. So far, we have listened to Mike Pence whining and complaining about what was Pence's problem? The Obama's stimulus bill, calling for more tax cuts, and questioned him about things that didn't make any sense. Then we heard from next we heard from Paul Ryan, Wisconsin, wanted to know why Obama didn't freeze spending immediately. Shelley Moore Capito, she wanted to know what Obama would do to create jobs in her state. Isn't that your job, Shelley? Then poor little Jason Chaffetz, a freshman representative from Utah, took Obama to task for breaking his campaign promises. All right. Now, Marsha Blackburn.
she went on and on and on, and hopefully Kathy has shortened her. So many of these Republicans, we got a chance to address the president. They were making a campaign video, and I think Obama knew it. If you watch, you knew it. I certainly knew it. But let's play along. Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee complained that Obama hadn't paid enough attention to Republican ideas and plans on health care reform. She said, "Thank you for acknowledging that Republicans have ideas on health care. We have over 50 bills. We have lots of amendments that would bring health care ideas to the forefront. And if those good ideas aren't making it to you, maybe it's the House Democrat leadership that is an impediment instead of a conduit. When will we sit down together to produce a product that is going to reduce government interference, reduce cost, and be fair to the American taxpayer?" Oh, please. Then Obama explains how difficult it is to sit at the table and negotiate a bipartisan compromise with a group of legislators who are accusing you of secretly working on a communist plot to destroy America.
Let me say this about health care and the health care debate, because I think it also bears on a whole lot of other issues. The component parts of this thing are pretty similar to what Howard Baker,
Republican,
Bob Dole,
Republican,
and Tom Daschle proposed at the beginning of this debate last year. Now, you may not agree with Bob Dole and Howard Baker, and Tom, certainly you don't agree with Tom Daschle on much, but that's not a radical bunch. But if you were to listen to the debate, and frankly how some of you went after this bill, you'd think that this thing was some Bolshevik plot. No, I mean, that's how you guys presented it. So all I'm saying is we've got to close the gap a little bit between the rhetoric and the reality.
A little bit?
I'm not suggesting that we're going to agree on everything, whether it's on health care or energy or what have you. But if the way these issues are being presented by the Republicans is that this is some wild-eyed plot to impose huge government in every aspect of our lives, what happens is you guys then don't have a lot of room to negotiate with me. I mean, the fact of the matter is that many of you, if you voted with the administration on something, are politically vulnerable in your own base, in your own party. You've given yourselves very little room to work in a bipartisan fashion, because what you've been telling your constituents is, this guy's doing all kinds of crazy stuff that's going to destroy America. And I would just say that we have to think about tone. It's not just on your side, by the way. It's on our side as well. This is part of what's happened in our politics, where we demonize the other side so much that when it comes to actually getting things done, it becomes tough to do.
Now, if you were watching this today, you saw Representative Blackburn from Tennessee with kind of a pursed lip look on her face as she listened to the president give her some, what Brother Dave Gardner used to call, some hard sayings. Hard saying. You know what hard saying? Brother Dave used to say, look, it isn't the pendulum swinging to and fro, but the essence that drives it that makes us go. Brother Dave used to say, there are those of us who are bound in the round who have a tendency to put down those who are bound in the square, but it's neither the round nor the square, but the spiral that leads to the top of the heap. Those are hard sayings. You want another one? You've given yourselves very little room to work in a bipartisan fashion, because what you've been telling your constituents is, I'm some kind of a crazy man who's out to destroy America. That's a hard saying, too. You see. So he's going to continue, see? He's trying to point out, in this case, to Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, over whose head all of this rushed, you can be sure. Because while he's answering her, she probably has one of those little earbuds in her listening to Beck or Limbaugh. Jesus. Then we get down
to one of my favorites, representative from Georgia, Tom Price, who happens to be, I think he's a pediatrician. He claims that Obama rejected a Republican-sponsored House bill that would have magically solved the health care crisis. This is what he said. On the general topic of health care, you have repeatedly said that Republicans have offered no ideas and no solutions. When you know that H.R. 3400 is a bill that would provide health coverage for all Americans, would correct the significant insurance challenges and lawsuit issues, would write into law that medical decisions are made between patients and families and doctors, except abortions, and does all of that without raising taxes by a penny. What should we tell our constituents who know that Republicans have offered positive solutions to the challenges that Americans face and yet continue to hear out of the administration that we've offered nothing? Another campaign commercial. Obama points out the fallacy of his claim that the GOP had a wondrous solution and Obama just rejected it, that any bill must be based on reality and not wishful thinking?
If you say we can offer coverage for all Americans and it won't cost a penny, that's just not true.
Bingo!
You can't structure a bill where suddenly 30 million people have coverage and it costs nothing. I mean, the easiest thing for me to do on the healthcare debate would have been to tell people that what you're going to get is guaranteed health insurance, lower your costs, all the insurance reforms. We're going to lower the cost of Medicare and Medicaid, and it won't cost anybody anything. That's great politics. It's just not true. So there's got to be some test of realism in any of these proposals, mine included. I've got to hold myself accountable. I guarantee the American people will hold themselves, will hold me accountable if what I'm selling doesn't actually deliver.
But, Mr. President, you kind of missed the point. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be a smart ass here, but you kind of missed the point. Dr. Tom Price, he's from Georgia. He's from here. I know about this man. I know about Tom Price. He's crazy. He honestly believes that H.R. 3400 would provide health coverage for all Americans, would correct all the significant insurance challenges like, oh, I don't know, pre-existing conditions for one, would cover all the lawsuit issues. That means put a cap. If somebody takes out your left kidney, the healthy one, and leaves the right one in the diseased one, well, what's that worth? $10,000? I mean, damn. And he's going to do all this without raising taxes by a penny. Tom Price apparently still eats tabs of acid. Hopefully he doesn't do it right before he examines a three-year-old. But, I mean, this is the kind of craziness that Obama stands up there and says, oh, look, can we inject just a little reality? He says, if you say that we can offer coverage for all Americans and it won't cost us a penny, that's just not true. See, that's what you say. This is what I'm talking about. That's what you say to a 10-year-old. Well, Johnny, I need to tell you something. If you honestly believe there's this great big fat guy in a red suit and a white beard who comes down, well, look, Johnny, we don't have a chimney every Christmas and leaves you presents under the tree. For God's sake, it's just not true. But that's what you say to a fifth grader if they get to that age and still think Santa Claus exists, as Tom Price still thinks magically. We have a bill here, H.R. 3400, where if it's just enacted into law, everybody has insurance. The doctors don't get sued. By the way, I'm a doctor, full disclosure. Nobody gets sued. Everybody gets insurance. Everything's wonderful. There's caps. You know, when I leave a sponge in somebody's lung, I may have to pay, a little bit higher premium, but I don't have to, provide them with money for the rest of their lives just because they couldn't breathe and now they're practically brain dead. It's all in H.R. 3400. No, it's not, Tom.
It's not an HR 3400 at all. Now sit down like a good pediatrician and shut up.
People running around in circles. Don't know what they're headed for. Everybody's crying peace on earth just as soon as we win this war. So straight ahead, knock 'em dead.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. We're just about finished. Continuing, the next one who stood up to confront the president and be confronted in return is Peter Roskam, a Republican from Illinois, one of Obama's former colleagues back home. And he wants to know, and it's all I could do to listen to this with a straight face. He wants to know, whatever happened to Obama's ability to work with the other side? Mr. President, Peter said, when you were a state senator, you took on some very controversial subjects. Death penalty reform, you and I worked together on that. You took on ethics reform. You took on some big things. One of the keys was you rolled your sleeves up, you worked with the other party, and ultimately you were able to make the deal. Over the past year, in my view, that attribute hasn't been in full bloom. And by that I mean you've got the subtext of House Republicans that sincerely want to come and be a part of this national conversation towards solutions, but they've really been stiff-armed by Speaker Pelosi. There really is this dynamic of, frankly, being shut out. I think all of us want to hit the reset button on 2009. How do we move forward? The obstacle is, frankly, the politics within the Democratic caucus. Peter, maybe the difficulties that you notice from Obama is the difficulties that comes from trying to work with a group of crazy people in a bipartisan fashion when they said you're a communist antichrist who want to force grandmas to commit suicide. Maybe that has something to do with the difficulty, Peter, in trying to work with you people.
That's one of the points that I made earlier. I mean, we've got to be careful about what we say about each other sometimes, because it boxes us in ways that makes it difficult for us to work together, because our constituents start believing us. They don't know sometimes this is just politics, what you guys, or folks on my side do sometimes.
What?
So just a tone of civility instead of slash and burn would be helpful. The problem we have sometimes is a media that responds only to slash and burn style politics. You don't get a lot of credit if I say, you know, I think Paul Ryan's a pretty sincere guy and has a beautiful family. Nobody's going to run that in the newspapers, right? And by the way, in case he's going to get a Republican challenge, I didn't mean it. Don't want to hurt you, man. But on the specifics, I think both sides can take some blame for a sour climate on Capitol Hill. What I can do maybe to help is to try to bring Republican and Democratic leadership together on a more regular basis with me. That's, I think, a failure on my part, is to try to foster better communications even if there's disagreement. And I will try to see if we can do more of that this year.
Oh, Mr. President. I mean, to question your ability to work with the other side, to be questioned by a Republican, the same political clutch of morons that produced the Bush crime family, When did George Bush or Dick Cheney or any of these people ever make any effort to work with the other side? I realize, Mr. President, that you're trying to rise above that. But when you have a question that comes from someone, a question that is based in either deliberate misdirection or obvious idiocy, why do you try to answer sincerely? Mr. President, do you think Peter Roskam, your old buddy from Illinois, gives a tinker's damn about what you just said? If he can ask a question that wonders why you can't work with the other side after the other side has insulted your mother, your grandmother, your father, your parentage collectively, your citizenship, your nationality, your race, your wife, and your children, then the man asking that question is an obvious jerk, or worse. But I promise not to curse on this program anymore. It's insane to try to deal with what remains of a political party that has degenerated into a collection of charlatans, liars, teabaggers, Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin. And then to be asked, well, Mr. President, why, you seem to have lost your ability to work with the other side. I mean, my God, you lost your ability. And the president's line, we got to be careful what we say about each other because, you know, sometimes the folks back home take it seriously. And then he says this, they don't know sometimes this is just politics. What you guys, you know, or folks on my side do sometimes, just politics, just politics. So suggesting that your wife has a relative that lived in a tree and liked bananas. That's just politics, Mr. President? Suggesting that your mother was a whore. That's just politics, Mr. President? I mean, it's one thing to reach out, Mr. Obama, but my God, these people want you dead. Or, I don't know, hasn't anyone told you that? I mean, we know that out here in the world. The number of death threats against the President of the United States has gone up by a factor of what since you took office? That's your trivia question for tonight. We'll be back after the break. Hey, Truth Seekers, this is Mike Malloy. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Mike Malloy Show, so please don't call in. We'll return live before you can say, Bush crime family. Welcome back. It's 6:30 past the hour. This is the Malloy program. Having fun? I am. I think it's good to listen to what Obama had to say today in response to these Republicans. Don't forget, this was, I think the invitation was more or less a joke so that they could say, well, we invited him to come to our caucus down there in Maryland. He wouldn't show up. And he did show up. And again, my opinion is it was like an adult addressing a room full of subdued but otherwise unruly tweens somewhere around fifth grade who needed to be told a few things about their deportment. There's a word for you. A few things about their attitude and a few things about how effective truth can be and how corrosive telling big old fat lies can be. The decision to film this, or to tape it, I should say, to video it, to and to let the American people see it live, I believe came from the White House. And if so, it was a great tactical move, because I think for independents, certainly not Republicans, Republicans have drunk so much Kool-Aid and taken so many blue pills as to render them completely unconscious. But I think for so-called independents, you know, the fence-sitters, the people who will not take a position, this may have been an enlightening experience, watching an adult deal with a room full of children whose job it is to make laws when they're working, which hasn't been this year. That's for damn sure. The last one we're going to play for you here is Jeb Hensarling from Texas. Now, Jeb, of course, asks, and Obama refers to him as Jim, which is understandable. Jeb asks a very long-winded question that sounds like what it is, a re-election campaign ad. Jeb says, we know that under current law, the government, the cost of government, is due to grow from 20% of our economy to 40% of our economy right about the time our children are leaving college and getting that first job. The Republicans proposed a budget that ensured that government did not grow beyond the historical standard of 20% of GDP. It was a budget that actually froze immediately non-defense discretionary spending. It spent $5 trillion less than ultimately what was enacted into law. And unfortunately, I believe that budget was ignored. Your administration, however, proposed a budget that would triple the national debt over the next 10 years. Surely you don't believe 10 years from now we will still be mired in this recession. Our budget proposed new entitlement spending and moved the cost of government to almost 20. Your budget, I'm sorry, proposed a new entitlement spending and moved the cost of government to almost 24.5% of the economy. You are soon to submit a new budget, Mr. President. Will that new budget, like your old budget, triple the national debt and continue to take us down the path of increasing the cost of government to almost 25% of our economy? And Kathy took about 80% of that out. Now, Obama goes into detail about all the lies and distortions in that question, how it undermines bipartisan efforts, and how it's impossible to get anything accomplished if the Republicans are going to keep saying things like that.
With all due respect, I've just got to take this last question as an example of how it's very hard to have the kind of bipartisan work that we're going to do, because the whole question was structured as a talking point for running a campaign.
Bingo again.
The fact of the matter is that when we came into office, the deficit was $1.3 trillion. 1.3. So when you say that suddenly I've got a monthly budget that is higher than the annual, or a monthly deficit that's higher than the annual deficit left by the Republicans, that's factually just not true. And you know it's not true. And what is true is that we came in already with a $1.3 trillion deficit before I had passed any law. What is true is we came in with $8 trillion worth of debt over the next decade. Had nothing to do with anything that we had done. It had to do with the fact that in 2000, when there was a budget surplus of $200 billion, you had a Republican administration and a Republican Congress, And we had two tax cuts that weren't paid for. You had a prescription drug plan, the biggest entitlement plan, by the way, in several decades, that was passed without it being paid for. You had two wars that were done through supplementals. That, and then you had $3 trillion projected because of the lost revenue of this recession. That's why I say if we're going to frame these debates in ways that allow us to solve them, then we can't start off by figuring out, A, who's to blame, B, how can we make the American people afraid of the other side? And unfortunately, that's how our politics works right now. That's how a lot of our discussion works. That's how we start off every time somebody speaks in Congress. The first thing they do, they stand up and all the talking points, you know, I see Frank Lutz up here sitting in the front. He's already pulled it and he said, you know, the way you're really gonna, I've done a focus group and, you know, the way we're gonna really box in Obama on this one or make Pelosi look bad on that one. I know, I like Frank. We've had conversations between Frank and I, but that's how we operate. It's all tactics. And it's not solving problems.
It's all tactics. And it's not solving problems. I just wish you would stop using a collective pronoun. We. Our. Us. Obama's apparently unmitigated insistence that there is mutual responsibility here about the collapse of our political system really grates. It grates on my nerves because it is not true. It simply is not true. It wasn't true last year, 10 years ago, 40 years ago, or 78 years ago. It wasn't true then or now. There is one party of obstructionism. There's one regressive, reactionary party in this country, and it is the Republican Party. He says if we're going to solve things, we can't start off by figuring out, A, who's to blame? Why not? Or B, we can't make the American people afraid of the other side. I'm terrified of Republicans. Are you kidding me? They're trying to kill me. They're trying to kill my children, my grandchildren. They're trying to turn my country as imperfect as it is and always has been into a fascist state. I'm not to be afraid of them. Come on, Barack. I can appreciate Mr. Obama's desire. But look, it's been a year, Mr. President. You started out by inviting these creepy bastards in for tea. Don't you remember? Huh? Come on over, boys. And the habitually tanned boner shows up and the rest of these thugs. And you had your tea. And they came out all smirky and stood there in the driveway of the White House talking about how, well, you know, that was pretty nice, but you know what? We're going to cut this son of a bitch's throat. Mr. Obama, please stop trying to make nice with these thugs.
Freedom.
because without dissent, it's not America. Here's Mike Malloy.
Welcome back. All right. After this next break that comes up here in about 7 minutes, we're going to do tonight's, Friday night's podcast trivia event where, we give away a one-year subscription to our commercial-free podcast downloads of this program. So Kathy's going to open the lines in a minute. If you'd like to play the trivia and continue with comments about what we've done tonight, then we'll do that. If you just want to get on for the trivia aspect, that will work too. Oh, by the way, if you watched Virginia Governor Robert McDonald's Republican response to Obama's State of the Union the other night, you noticed something, right? Especially after Paiush Jindal's speech last year, the Louisiana governor. Remember that? Where he came, I swear to God, he looked like some sort of a... see, anything I say now, they're going to say, well, you're a racist. You're a racist. Okay. I really don't care. Of course I'm a racist. But Paiush Jindal standing there, wasn't there a stairwell behind him or something, or stairway? And he had that smarmy grin on his face. I'm not going to say it. I'm just not. Kathy's looking at me and saying, no, don't say what you were going to say. You know, Kathy knows I'm a closet racist, and I'm not closet about it. I've admitted on this program many, many times. I struggle against it. But there was something about Paiush Jindal last State of the Union response night that just turned my stomach and almost made me swear off Indian food for at least a week. But anyway, this year, they decided to do it differently. They had people sitting in a semicircle. Or was it a circle around this? How long has this guy been governor of Virginia? 10 days? Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, get somebody like that to respond to the State of the Union address. But anyway, there he was, Virginia Governor Robert McDonald, trying to look all presidential. They even had two or three cameras that would pan. Had at least two that would pan to the audience. Somebody applauding a statement in a response to. And I don't get the response idea anyway. Where does that come from? There's no fairness doctrine anymore. What's the point? Why are the networks giving so-called equal time? It's not equal time. Why are the networks doing this? To hell with this. You know, the president makes a State of the Union speech. Where is it written down that the Republicans then have 15 minutes to come on and crap all over what the man just said? Lee Fang, writing over at Think Progress, said today, when McDonnell, the governor, Virginia governor, opposes Obama's proposed efforts to break up the big banks, to regulate the financial sector, and impose a financial responsibility fee to financial institutions, which helped cause the current recession, it should be noted that the very industry McDonald is fighting to defend underwrote the platform on which he's speaking, both virtually and in Richmond. In other words, the McDonald's campaign, his ascension to the governorship, his speech, and the set from which he spoke is underwritten by Wall Street. Now, that's not a news flash. I'm not trying to caption that as though I'm telling you, hey, I want to tell you something. Dust will make you sneeze. No, I'm just saying. The next largest contributor to McDonald was the coal industry. And McDonald, in his rebuttal, said, we are blessed here in America with vast natural resources, and we must use them all. But Obama already said that. I mean, Obama's talking about something that exists only in fairy tales. Clean coal. There is no such thing. It doesn't exist. That's like saying non-nuclear nuclear reactors. Ha-ha!
But just thought you'd like to know that the Virginia Republican governor, Robert McDonald's response to Obama's State of the Union was underwritten by big banks, the financial sector, the coal industry, and so on and so on. It is just one more in a continuing parade of glaring examples of what the Republican Party is, was, always has been. It is the party of corrupt corporations, but I repeat myself. It is a party that has zero respect for the effort by the framers of this country to get something started that would be fair and just. It is the Republican Party. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Do you have 10?
Time once again for podcast trivia here on the Malloy program, where you can win a free one-year subscription to commercial-free podcasts. So, all you have to do is get the right answer to a question that we ask you. It's multiple choice. You remember back from the days when you were in elementary school, that's the easiest one to answer. Let's start with Mike in Salt Lake City. No, Mike, you don't want to play trivia, do you?
No, I want to talk
okay.
about...
Okay, all right, I'll tell you what. Hold on a second. Let me put you back on...
Uh-oh.
Wait a minute. Where am I here? Wait a minute. Mike, call back in. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. All right. Where are we? We're right here. I'm sorry. Charlie in Utah. Hey, Charlie. Listening.
Hey, Mike.
Listening on Sirius. All right. I'm sorry. Got everything screwed up. I've got it back together now. I'm just all a flutter. You ready to play trivia?
Mike, I'm ready to play. It's a pleasure listening to you.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. Here we go. Music maestro, if you will. Which Supreme Court justice broke all traditional rules of nonpartisan decorum by shaking his head and mouthing the words, not true, when Obama was discussing their recent decision in Citizens United versus FEC? Was it A, Kennedy, B, Thomas, C, Scalia, or D, Alito?
Don't you have a harder one than that? That's Alito.
Alito, Sammy the Fish Alito. You're absolutely right. Way to go. Ah, sound effects are very loud tonight. Ah, all right, Charlie, way to go. When we are finished with the call, I'll put you on hold, and Kathy will get almost called her Sally. Sally,
Kathy will,
Kathy will get the pertinent information. I don't think I know a Sally.
I'm not going to talk to about Sally.
All right, Charlie. What else you got?
Two things. One is I think Harry Reid and the people of Nevada should really start pointing the finger at the state of Virginia and West Virginia and saying, hey, what? You want the nuclear waste that's going to the mountains that you're blowing holes in for coal.
Yeah.
And for all the...
I just said, yeah, go ahead.
And for those red states that are really pushing for nuclear, why don't we locate or erect the new nuclear plants within their borders?
I wish you wouldn't say that, because here in Georgia, I think we
have... I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have five or six nuclear plants here, and I think the drawing board is producing plans by the Southern Company, which is one of the worst polluters in America. The Southern Company that owns Georgia Power, Alabama Power, Florida Power and Electric, I think. The Southern Company, which by any estimation is killing more people with its pollution of atmosphere, groundwater, and the very earth itself, they, I believe, have applied for licenses from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Believe it or not, there still is such a thing. And their plan is to build more. Now, the catch is, of course, it's going to cost billions in order for them to do this. So you know what they're doing? They have requested from the state of Georgia, I think I've got this all correct, and have gotten from the Georgia's the board here in Georgia that sets power rates, they have gotten a rate increase 8 years before this thing is scheduled to go online. 8 years in advance, we, the citizens of Georgia, and this is true with any in any state where so-called private industry, right? Private industry wants to make sure that their asses are covered before they even start building this this horrendous nuclear power plant. So I'm not surprised at all that if there's not a line of people wanting to get in on Barack Obama's idea of more nuclear power plants. It's just insane.
Termination plan.
Say it again?
Termination plan.
Yeah, that too. All right, listen, Charlie, thank you. I appreciate you checking in. Hold on, and Kathy will get the information, and congratulations on winning that 1 year subscription. Yeah, that's the magic of free enterprise. Huh? Don't you Republicans love it? You smarmy little creeps. Huh? The magic of the free enterprise system. You want to build a nuclear power plant. It's going to cost $15 billion to build it. So what do you do? Do you get your investors together and build it? Why, of course not. I mean, how 20th century is that? The financial services industry has proved you don't have to do that at all. You just whack the public with the debt. That's all. It's straight out of The Sopranos. It's very easy to do because most Americans are too damn stupid to understand what's going on. A, B, the Republican governors in the various states, including Georgia, think it's a grand old scheme, really, when you get down to it. So you just get the Public Services Commission. Or the Public Service Commission in the various states, usually staffed by the same Republicans that run the governor's office now, get them to okay a rate increase. Not because the power company is delivering more expensive electricity, but because 10 years down the road, it will be delivering more expensive electricity. So get the money now. Right? Of course, anyone who deals in actuarial tables in the state of Georgia will tell you that a hefty percentage of the people making those payments now will be dead by the time the nuclear plant goes online. So they will never get their money back, so to speak, because the obesity rate and high blood pressure rate in the state of Georgia is among the top in the country. But isn't that fun? You see, that's how private enterprise works. None of this damn socialism. Let's do private enterprise. Capitalism. Yeah. Get the money up front. And when enough of the suckers die, well, you know. Patrick is in Monterey, California. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm always better when I listen to your guys' show.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You and the progressive talk show lineup on KRXA and Ray Todd Farrow and Comedy Central and every once in a while some good sense of me are probably the only things that have kept what little sanity I have left the last 10 years.
I hear that. I hear that.
I wanted to ask you about the flying monkey people, but before I do, I do want to make a couple points. I love your guys' bumper music. I mean, it was like a few months ago. I'm like, he's playing David Sylvian and Robert Fripp. Nobody plays these guys.
Right. Well, one night.
And I wanted to make a couple suggestions, you know. Mental note, whenever the subject of fascism comes up, I would highly recommend David Bowie and Tin Machines,
there you
Under
go.
The God. And whenever Sarah Palin is the topic, Adrian Belew's Men in Helicopters, I think, would be perfect.
That would be good.
Um, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, this Obama reboot is actually real and it's not just, okay, I get it, he's another corporate Democrat. I'm hoping that maybe there's some miracle that we put enough pressure on him. I've started a postcard from Monterey Peninsula campaign because I figure he's not going to read it, all the mail he's deluged with, but I want everyone from my local mail carrier to the people that screen the mail at the White House to read my comment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of inching back cautiously towards him because of his little exchange with the Republicans today.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I really do feel like in future presidential elections, my choices when I go into the voting booth are either Hannibal Lecter or the Maytag repairman. You know, I have to vote between a psychopath or some seat warmer who's not going to do a damn thing.
Right, right.
But when I was watching this exchange, and it was brilliant, it was very heartwarming to see him just pick apart these Republican idiots. But they kept, you know, having complimentary things they were tossing back and forth, and they're pimping their families, and, oh, you've got a wonderful family. And I'm like, yes, they are breeding. And they do have, like, what look like normal humans. And I just wanted to hear your take on, are these people really that stupid? Or are they that insulated? You know, like, in the extent that I read recently that Bernie Sanders is the only senator who's not a millionaire. Mm-hmm. Do these people just feel like, F them, I've got mine? Or do they not realize that their policies for the last 30 years or since the Republican Party's entered the 20th century, much less the 21st, are destroying the middle class? I wanted to hear your take on it.
Well, to me, Republicans have not changed, Patrick, since the Hoover administration, and maybe before that. That's about as far back as I can go with any kind of real ability to understand what these rat bastards have done. The Republican Party is, you know, just chock-a-block with people who really do not like the system of government, self-government here, that we've been working on for over two centuries to try to get it right. They don't like representative government. It's too messy. Look, U.S. foreign policy for the past 100 years has been to deal with those governments that are extreme right-wing. Dictatorship, military dictatorships is the form of government we prefer to deal with because they are not messy. You can get things done instantly. Well, the Republicans would like to institute that here. Now, maybe not so much on the military side because all Republican office holders are cowards. Very few of them have ever put on a uniform, not even a Boy Scout uniform. So my take on the Republican Party is that they are working to destroy this country, period, our system of government, and replace it with a form of fascism that eventually will destroy the country literally with all the pollution, and the waste and the destruction. That's my take on it. Patrick, thanks, man. I got a break here. Appreciate you checking in. Before the hour.
When is your mission complete?
Thanks to our loosey-goosey crew here, none of whom are here. They're all scattered around the country, but they contribute a lot to the program. Sharon Gordy, who's our military affairs correspondent. Bruce Enberg, our economic affairs dude. Kay Petrini, education affairs. Ethics on this program are overseen by Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. A lot of people say, well, what does that mean? What do you mean they're ethics advisors? Well, all I mean is if I go too far in criticizing, I will get an email from one of them. One or two instances, I think I got emails from both.
Sometimes emails are rather oblique, but the point is made. So it's just my way of knowing that there are a couple of people out there who listen a little more critically to this program in a positive way. And if I get too much in attack mode about a certain subject, whatever that subject might be, then, you know, that's why they get paid the big bucks. And, of course, our engineer and executive producer is Catherine Bay. Okay, there's Mike in Salt Lake City. Sorry I hung up on you the first time. My bad.
Oh, that's okay, Mike. Well, Mike, I want to talk to you about what the Republicans said during the, you know, Obama-Republican exchange about health care. I think the Republicans are just joking with Obama when they say they have some meaningful health care reform.
Yeah, really?
You know, the only two things I've talked to Utah Republicans, and they've said to me two things. Their proposal for health care reform is number one, have a medical savings account.
Oh.
I always respond and say, let's get real here.
Yeah.
You know, most of the working families are living paycheck to paycheck. They don't got money to start with a MSA. So there, that doesn't work. Second thing, they give me this fantasia about a free market in the, you know, health care field.
Mm-hmm.
Fact. Let me tell you what the facts are. The medical industry, the hospital industry, and the healthcare insurance industry is one collusive monopoly.
Yeah, it is. And besides, even if you granted them a little bit of credence to that argument, what are you supposed to do when you're given a cancer diagnosis? Are you supposed to shop for the best deal? Do you go to hospital A and say, well, how much do you charge for the surgery and the chemo? You charge $47,900. And you go to the hospital B, what do you charge for the, I mean, it's madness. And besides, when they talk about these, medical savings accounts, that is bull hockey of the highest order. Do these people understand what a bypass operation costs? Do they understand what a simple appendectomy costs? Apparently not.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, let me tell you, the only answer I could think of is if we could manufacture, you know, some 50s and 60s flying saucer, we all can go over to Inja and get it for about a third done what we get charged by the medical industry here in the USA.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you checking in. Every time I hear talk about these medical savings accounts, I just want to pimp slap somebody. I really do. I mean that from the very bottom of my heart. What are you talking about? What are these people talking about? For the past, 10 years, we have had almost a negative savings rate in this country anyway, just generally speaking. And whatever, quote, savings, end quote, people had was in this phony equity that was supposed to be resting inside people's homes in the actual physical structure. Medical savings account. Oh, yeah, well, that's a Republican plan. See, yeah, we'll make it tax deductible. Okay, let's supposing somebody can save, let's be real extreme here, $100 a month into a medical savings account. What is that, $1,200 after a year? After 10 years, even with compound interest, what would that be, 20 grand, 25? What does $25,000 get you when you need surgery, when you need dialysis, when you need chemotherapy, when you not that any of this stuff does any good. We all know that. Chemotherapy, I guess in some instances, it extends life. Certainly not the quality of life, but it extends life, right? I mean, I don't know. I've not been there. I hope I never get there. Radiation treatments. Man. I had a lump in my thyroid, a nodule, that scared the bejesus out of me 9 years ago. I went to the University of Chicago Medical Center and had it removed by a thyroid specialist who wrote the book or the chapter in the medical books about how to get these damn things out. And I had insurance. And what was the bottom line, Kathy, had we had to pay for that? It was approaching $45,000. to have a nodule removed. And these freaks talk about medical savings accounts. Well, you see, that's the Republican idea. They know it's fantasy. They know it's impossible to for a working class man or woman to do that. And what's left of the middle class? Please. But the self-delusion continues. This is what Republicans do. We're about out of time. Cue up Kevin Kenney, will you please? Y'all have a great weekend. Be careful if you're in the vast midsection of the country, right? Snow, ice, sleet, rain, freezing. If you're Republicans, get out, go to the store, and when you hit an icy patch, floor it. We'll see you Monday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Straight to hell, just like my mama said. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kenney, wherever you are. Oh, God, I was just kidding.
Individual results may vary.